I'm Joanne Wilson, and this is Positively Gotham Gal, meaningful conversations with women entrepreneurs about their approach to life, business, and everything in between. Nadia Bujara is the co-founder and CEO of Dia & Co., a shopping and style resource for plus-size fashion. Nadia and I talked about how she took her career from investment banking analyst to starting her own business and all the hurdles in between. You didn't start out in the clothing industry.
I did not. I like to say that I've always been a shopper, so in some ways I did start out in the clothing industry, but not professionally. Most women do. I'm amongst the most avid. I started on Wall Street. I started as an investment banker.
Did you even like that?
I did. It was an interesting challenge. I mean, being an analyst in an investment bank is like an endurance sport. It's not really like an intellectual. It is intellectually stimulating, but I wouldn't say I was doing deeply interesting work. It was just like, how many hours could you work?
I like that. It's an endurance sport.
Yeah, it really was. I think the first year that I was an analyst, in the 365 days of that year, I maybe got one day off.
Wow.
I mean, it truly is an endurance sport.
And were you, in terms of females on that floor, like what percentage were you? One?
So I was, this is shocking, but true. I was the only female analyst in my class globally at the firm at the time.
That's unbelievable.
So it was a small firm. It's bigger now. But, you know, they already had offices in San Francisco and in London and other places. And there were no women.
And when you took that job, I'm sure you probably didn't ask that question.
No, of course not.
Right. And then you got there. And do you remember what your like guttural reaction was looking around and saying, yeah. Whoa.
I'm not sure how aware of it I was, to be totally honest. I think I've always been in situations where there are fewer women. I grew up in the Middle East.
Okay.
Which was...
Where in the Middle East?
I grew up in Kuwait.
Okay.
And I was always kind of like more ambitious and was practical, which meant that I did all the things that the boys were doing.
Right.
And so I think that it was always, until I started Dia, I'd never worked in an environment where there were a lot of women.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. That, I mean, now Dia is the opposite.
Well, as it should be.
Yeah.
And so at what point did you decide, you know, I've endured.
Yeah.
And I'm going to now move on to something else.
So I stayed there for 3 years.
Okay.
And it
was... Which is a solid thing under your belt.
It was a solid thing under my belt. I honestly, it was a great experience. My greatest mentor came from my time there. I learned a lot. I learned perspective on how business leaders make decisions. It felt like I was in the room on important conversations. Like, it was really, really positive.
Right.
I just didn't want to be doing that.
For the rest of your life.
For the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And I didn't actually know what I wanted to do. And so I did what I thought was the responsible thing, which was go to business school.
Well, you know, I do think a lot of people go to business school when they're not sure what's the next direction.
Yeah.
And how do I shift my career into another lane when I've just spent 3 years in essentially the banking industry, when I'm pretty sure that's where I don't want to hang my hat forever.
I think that's exactly right. I think business school is best suited for what you just described.
Yeah.
And it really... I think it's hard to make the case for going to business school if you think you're going to do the same thing afterwards as you were doing before.
Well, particularly if you're going to spend that kind of money.
I mean, it is a huge investment.
Yeah. It was $150,000.
At least.
I mean, that's just the education. That doesn't include the food and the
right,
and your
the
bed.
Income and for those 2 years.
Yes.
I mean, it's a very expensive thing.
It
is a huge investment that I think rarely makes sense unless you take a very long-term view.
Yeah.
And if you really want to make a change in your life, that it's hard to imagine really being able to navigate that without having like a pivot point that you can really...
Totally. I think years ago, you know, when my husband went to business school, he pivot pointed. That's how he used business school. But many were told at that point, okay, you can't get this level in the banking industry and you need to go to business school to jump that.
Yeah.
And now that's completely different.
That is gone. I think that there's some industries where that's still true. But I think that that has... come out of vogue for sure.
For sure.
Yeah.
And so you went to business school for 2 years. You had exposure to new people, new thoughts, new businesses, new verticals, new everything.
Really new everything. I mean, business school for me was in a lot of ways like sensory overload from a interests perspective, just because it was such a diverse group of people. very few people who looked like me who had my experiences, which was the first time that I'd really been in an environment like that. And it's really kind of a...
Well, that's amazing.
It's amazing. And everybody's very passionate, right? And it, like, the professors are very passionate about what they do. Everyone is there, you know, on a mission to change the world in some way or another.
Including themselves.
Exactly. And it was just, it was a very inspiring place to dream for a little bit.
And so when you got out, you came to New York.
Mm-hmm. So we actually started thinking about DIA while we were at business school. My co-founder was a classmate of mine at business school.
Was it something that was like a late night conversation, or yeah, was it something that you took a class, or is it something that's been sitting in your head since the time you were a little kid trying on clothes in a dressing room?
So it was a moment where a bunch of dots got connected for the first time. And it was interesting. What actually sparked it was an article in the New York Times in the fall of 2012.
Okay.
That was profiling what they said at the time was this really interesting social media phenomenon, the rise of plus size style bloggers. And it was, you know, kind of an exploration of how different these women looked than where style authority had come from in the past, which were the magazines and the editors and, you know, that whole world.
Hangers.
Yeah. And it was like, it blew my mind to think about the fact that the New York Times would be writing about these women who looked nothing like the women that I'd grown up, you know, kind of cutting out of magazines and putting on my wall kind of stuff, was just really fascinating. And it triggered a set of reflections, I guess, about how much not having women like that in my life had actually been an impact on how I saw myself, who I thought I was, how I carried myself. You know, that was basically the beginning of a rabbit hole that we still haven't come out of.
Right. Well, you know, I was a buyer for the large size department. Hmm. This was in 1988. Roughly in that time period. And, you know, that department was always put on a different level. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was an assistant store manager, that department was downstairs away from all the other departments. And I think, like, you know, towels or something was like on the other side. And it was like literally hidden in a corner.
Okay. So it's 20 years later.
Yeah. And 20 years later. And
that has not changed.
That has not changed one iota. But what's interesting is that if you look at this data, which is 60% of women are oversized 12. Why aren't we just creating Missy businesses for them? Because they are a larger part of the, you know, world. And it makes zero sense to me. Even to this day, I mean, really, you, DIA, has pulled out of the race as the runner and winner. But there should be hundreds of them. Because there's only thousands of sites for
on the other side of
the other set of women.
I mean, people say this to me all the time. They're like, oh, isn't that, you know, X, Y, and Z retailer does that, right? And it's like, yes, X, Y, and Z retailer, you know, Lane Bryant, for example. Lane Bryant does sell plus size clothing. Why don't we play a game? We'll sit here and you name all the retailers that serve,
that serve this industry.
The other side of the market.
Right.
That represents now 30% of women, right? So the latest stats are that 67% of women wear a size 14 or above, which is the sizes that we cater to.
Right.
And we would be here all day and we wouldn't get to the end of the list of the retailers who serve the 30% of women who wear smaller sizes.
No, it's amazing.
Even today, as far into this as we are, it boggles my mind.
So when you started DIA, was it, you know, you sat in front of a whiteboard and you guys decided like, wow, there's a really interesting opportunity here?
Not really. We kind of just dove in. I'd never thought about the market in macro statistics, right? Okay. I'd always thought about it as I'm a woman who's always been plus size. I know deeply what my experiences have been. I've never really thought about how this fits into a bigger picture. And then, you know,
started doing the research
coming out of reading that article. And it was just, I was, you know, it was almost like continuing to do the research to see like when the other shoe was going to drop, because mm-hmm. there must be something that I'm missing about how this could be the case. That was 6 years ago and we still haven't found like the aha moment of like, there is a secret that we didn't know about why this could be the case.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's like any great disruptive business.
Right. And,
you know, and people are like, no one's done that?
Yeah. No.
No.
They haven't.
Right.
And the truth is that there probably need to be dozens or, and honestly, like if we were actually going to reach parity in what these industries look like,
complete
there would
flip.
Need to be thousands of businesses that come into this space.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And in reality, I think that part of what's so difficult And when you really end up spending time thinking about why the market is the way that it is, what we realize is that so much of what we as plus size women think about in terms of our shopping behaviors are learned over decades.
Correct.
You know, we don't think that we can participate. We don't think that we should wear this or that. We think that we need to wear only these things. And, you know, accessories are our friends because they're not size-based. We don't want it. Like, there's so many things that if you're actually going to get this woman to say, this is for you, you can let go of all of these things that have held you back for so long and just enjoy it, because style is fun. Style is self-expression. Style is the way that you carry yourself, and it's the first way that somebody kind of understands who you are when they meet you for the first time, and you should be able to participate in that. That takes a long time.
Well, you're re-educating women.
And that's where, because that's hard, that ends up being why people give up before they actually make progress. Because you really have to be committed to saying, we're not just here to make money. We're here to really transform the way that 100 million women think about themselves as consumers of retail. And we understand that that is a multi-decade problem.
You're absolutely right. Talk a little bit about, you need money to build a business. And what was that like going out and trying to convince people on the other side of the table that this opportunity is there in black and white data and we're going to disrupt it?
Yeah. I mean, to your point around disruptive or contrarian ideas, I think the challenge is that people don't see it. And so being able to get somebody to understand the fact that I know that the world looks very different today, but I believe beyond a shadow of a doubt that it can and should look very different in the future is hard. And, you know, I think that there are a lot of different layers of difficulty in a conversation like that. Mm-hmm. You know better than anyone. The realities of raising money as a female entrepreneur.
It's awful.
It's awful.
It is.
And
particularly when you're talking about e-commerce, women's clothing, and then on top of it, plus-size clothing.
You know, it literally is. You know, every possible disadvantage from pattern matching that you can have as an investor, we faced.
I'm sure.
There was nobody who was doing this.
I mean, as I said, I was in this business. She had been a fashion blogger in that space for 15 years. You know, same exact what you're talking about. Accessories are our friend. I mean, all of these issues she went through. And, you know, people would say, well, there's one other company doing that, so why should there be a second?
Yeah. I know. It's like, well, unless that company is planning on doing $200 billion in revenue this
exactly.
year.
Exactly.
Like, there should probably be other people in the category.
Right. So what was the first thing you did when you entered the business? Was it aggregating clothes, making clothes?
So we did something, which in retrospect was a great idea, although I can't tell you for sure why we decided to start this way. But we basically said, we need to understand what shopping looks like from the eyes of as many women as possible.
Okay.
If we're really going to know what the solution here is. And so we worked with one of the bloggers, not coincidentally, one of the women who was actually profiled in the New York Times piece. And we asked her to put up a survey for her followers to say, ask a bunch of questions. And then if they were okay with us reaching out to them, we would reach out to them.
Data.
Exactly. early starts in data. Hundreds of women answered that survey, and we ended up having hundreds of email addresses. And we basically started emailing those women and saying, hey, we want to go shopping for you. Can we get on the phone and hear a little bit about your style, what you may be interested in? We will go out and shop for you and we'll send you stuff. And then you can tell us
what works, what doesn't.
What doesn't work. We did that for a long time. Well, almost a year.
Probably had some people that were just so excited to be part of this.
I mean, it was like, it was what ultimately meant I quit my job, because I can't even explain the reactions that we were getting on the phone from women who didn't know who we were.
Oh, I'm
like,
sure.
We were total strangers. And they were just like, is this a dream? Like, how is this happening? Like,
finally, someone knows what I'm going through.
We ended up probably personally shopping in that way for hundreds of women.
And how did you do that?
It went back to an endurance sport kind of thing. I would wake up in the morning, I'd put on like my workout gear and my tennis shoes and a backpack, and I'd hit Herald Square. And I shopped at Macy's, I shopped at Lord & Taylor, I shopped at JCPenney.
Now we work.
Not yet, but soon, yes. Soon to be, which is
crazy.
We shopped online. And we basically learned like every nook and cranny of the industry from the perspective of different women across the country. So if we were shopping for, you know, a 26-year-old elementary school teacher in Nashville, and we had a good sense for what she was looking for, where could she shop? If we were shopping for a 55-year-old nurse in Wisconsin who had a certain set of style, you know, preferences,
right,
where was she shopping? And what did it actually look like? Not just from our perspectives, because mm-hmm. obviously we had a lot of personal experience in this space, but actually understanding if we're going to get a 360 view of what the current state of the union is, what does that look like? And the remarkable thing was that whether you were a 25-year-old or 26-year-old teacher in Nashville or a 55-year-old nurse in Wisconsin, you were shopping in the same places.
Because you had no choice.
Because there was nowhere else to go.
Right.
And that was probably the first kind of eye-opening experience, because you'd had these women who would tell you in such interesting like color how differently they wanted to be able to present themselves, and the outcome was always the same.
It was the accessories was the only thing that changed their lives.
Accessories is the only thing that changed their lives. What also became clear from that experience was that this woman is shopping online, right? This is primarily an online shopper in apparel, which is pretty unique for the category. One of the outcomes of that is that she's always shopping alone. What we heard time and again was a description of a shopping experience that was very solitary and almost like private. Like she didn't want other people to be involved in the shopping experience unless there was some kind of a trusted relationship, which is what we were building with her.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, it was fascinating.
Well, and particularly then, when the department stores, even though there is one like A. Lane Bryant,
right,
which was never as beautiful and jazzy as The Limited, you know, it was... It's the department is downstairs in the back, dark, crappy lighting. You know, that's not a wonderful experience.
It's a terrible experience.
And women go shopping together for a fun experience. And that was not a fun experience.
It was not a fun experience. It's a very, you have to take a very practical approach to saying, I'm going in, I need to buy X, Y, and Z things, and then I'm going to leave.
Right.
Because everything else around this experience is miserable, and I'd like to minimize how much time I spend on this as possible. Like when we talk to women about what it was like to go into stores, you hear a lot of different versions of this, but almost every version was a very anxiety-ridden experience.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if my size is available. I'd really prefer not to ask a sales associate. The fitting rooms are sometimes too small. It gets so hot in the fitting room. This is so miserable.
Oh.
I'll just buy it. I'll try it on at home. I'll return it if I have to. It was just, you know.
It was misery.
It was misery. And it was like very clear that it would be hard to spend more money in this category right now.
So you compiled all this data and you both looked at each other and said, okay, now.
Yeah. Now we got to be super practical because we want to build a business. We understand where the pain points are. Let's force rank what we think the biggest obstacles are to getting her to really kind of come to the table in full force, and let's start building. And so the first thing was the actual shopping experience is miserable. You know, she needs a shopping experience where she's actually going to be able to get product that she likes.
Mm-hmm.
Let's build that first. And so that's where we started with Home Try-On.
So did you... like launch with those email addresses and all those people. And what happened?
We
blew up.
We just like people ask all the time, like, when did you launch? And it was like, we just kind of rolled into it. And
right.
Those 300 email addresses
right.
built into 1,000 email addresses. And
it's like, now we're having conversations.
4 million email addresses
right.
later. We're,
now we know this information. And by the way, and now we have clothes for you.
Yeah. Ooh. And so we started and we thought, we want to be able to have her have like a service experience. Like the idea of clienteling in retail was completely absent from mm-hmm. what she was experiencing. And so let's actually make sure that she has a connection with somebody who really cares about getting her the right product, who understands her, who's empathetic towards what her, you know, fears may be around certain things and can really get her something really awesome. Let's make sure she can try it on at home where she's comfortable. And let's take the guessing work out of fit for her. Let's make sure that we understand how garments fit. And that if she's going to try something on, we're pretty sure it's going to work well.
And how'd you do that?
Initially, that started with a lot of practice and fit testing. Eventually, that's where the majority of our technology has been built, because you can learn a lot in aggregate with millions of data points about how garments fit and mm-hmm. who they're most likely to fit best. But our appreciation for the importance of fit came from the very beginning. And it's kind of been a hallmark of... where we focused.
What was the number one garment that sold first that you saw? Oh, because I know from my experience in the wholesale world is we had this one jacket.
Yeah.
the 196. That was the dial number.
Yeah.
We could sell this jacket to petite, to missy, yeah. to large sizes. And I had sold this jacket to Sears, and they did a trial of like 2,400 units. And she said, you know, this is doing great. We're going to get back into it. And it was my first $1 million order. And it came through on a fax machine. She didn't even tell me it was coming. And I was like, oh, my God.
But that was a great fax.
It was a great thing. But that jacket was yeah. literally the key to the entire business model.
Yeah, that's interesting. For us, it's denim.
Denim. Interesting.
It was jeans.
That's interesting because denim is so hard no matter what size you are.
I know. Denim, we do better.
I can try in 30 pair of denim and just think they all look terrible.
We do better in denim than any other category.
That's amazing. Well, what's amazing about that, if you can do well in denim,
yeah.
you can do amazing, period.
And I think that's been an important theme for us. If we can start from the hardest problem first, most importantly, you gain her trust. Right, because if you can sell a woman the pair of jeans that she's excited to put on every day, you've earned the right to sell her tops and jackets and accessories and anything else. But you're helping her build the foundation of her wardrobe.
Totally.
And denim, to this day,
is the number one.
It's just the number. It's just the number
and
one.
And so, are you making the garments? Are you aggregating garments? Do you have a design team now?
Yeah.
Are you making, you know, where are you making the most of these products?
So, all of the above. We started as an aggregator mm-hmm. because we wanted to be able to get off the ground quickly.
Right. And that's the only way to do it.
Yeah. And, you know, to your point around how do you get people to invest in you, to back you, to actually see a vision, for us, we were determined to show traction as quickly as possible.
Right.
And that meant not waiting for bells and whistles and just saying, like, look, this is not a brand that was developed in a fancy branding agency in New York City.
No, this was the roots up.
This, we're shipping our packages in free USPS boxes. And, like, we can't keep up with what's happening. We're funding it ourselves. So, as, you know.
Which, by the way, when I meet founders that have taken their own capital yeah. and thrown it into their business, I mean, to put their own skin in the game, that is yeah. very eye-opening and should be for any investor on the other side of the
yeah.
table.
Well, I think it forces prioritization. And I think that
for sure, because you don't want to liquidate all your cash.
Yeah, it's like, I'm not spending money on that. Yes. Sorry. Like, if, unless it's literally going to drive measurable value to the customer, it's not going to be invested
right.
in.
Right.
And if the customer is telling us, I'm not buying your clothes because your boxes are ugly, we probably have a bigger problem.
Right.
And no one was saying that.
Yeah.
No, not once did she say, why are you guys sending these free ugly boxes?
Right.
She was saying, these jeans are amazing. And so that's what we focused on. And it got us really far. And it meant that by the time we were having conversations with, you know, seed funds, we had hundreds of thousands of dollars in
right.
revenue.
You had real
month.
Data and you had real and businesses.
We had feedback. We had customers. We were shipping orders. It was like,
it was amazing.
You know, a little operation.
So how long has Dia been around now?
We started in May of 2015.
That's amazing. And so what would your advice be, you know, if you talk to, and I'm sure you do, you know, other founders that are trying to find their way?
Yeah, I think that the reasons why you're passionate about an idea are the most important, because I think it's probably, it is easier for men to raise money and to, you know, do a whole bunch of things that end up being difficult parts of being a founder.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that it is easy for anybody.
For sure.
And,
and for sure not.
And what that means is that for us, at least, we knew we were working on something where the first 9,999 no's were going to have zero impact on our conviction and the fact that we should be doing this. And that gets you through, right? You have to be able to not...
white noise.
Yeah. And it was just like, I understand that you don't think this is a good business. We're going to get back to work because we have no doubt that it is. And it's like, it's resilience, right? And you get resilience. I think some people have resilience as a natural character trait, which
totally.
Is awesome. And I personally think that women have more resilience than men in aggregate.
Completely.
But I think that you also get like situational resilience from just having deep conviction in something.
Yes. I think what you did too, you dug into data.
Yeah.
And I am not convinced that many do. You know, they wake up, you know, this is a really interesting area that I think has a hole in the market.
Right.
And then they start. And I'm not so sure they really figure out why.
Yeah.
I always like to understand, you know, if there's a drip in the ceiling, you don't just turn off the water. I want to know, why is there a drip in that ceiling?
Right.
Like, you got to figure out where it came from. And you basically, you know, went back and tried to decipher all that data. And you asked those customers, what is it that they needed?
Yeah.
And, you know, we see time and time again, businesses that say, you know, we think that our customers are really going to want this. And I'm like, did you ask your customers? Like, or you just have a gut?
Yeah.
You know, you've got these customers, they know better than you.
Yeah. I think that's right. And I think that for us, it was less around saying we have a solution that we think is really exciting, which is like a product-led approach to entrepreneurship. We said, there's a problem here that we're really going to understand. And our sole focus is on building a solution to that problem. And we think that that problem is important because we're personally invested in it. It exists on a scale that is unmatched in the world of consumer. Mm-hmm. And therefore, what we're going to become experts in is the problem. And then we can build many solutions over time, which is basically the approach that we've taken. So, like, to go back to your question from before, do we aggregate or do we sell? We've basically done everything that we've done in succession in our business has been a result of the next biggest pain point for our customers. So we started with aggregation. We very quickly realized that there are very few players in the market.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're aggregating 10 things, you're not much of an aggregator. It's just not that exciting. We need to start creating supply. And so we started creating our own brands. That business has grown tremendously. Almost half of our business today comes from
your brands
that we've created. You know, as we kind of look forward to the next big changes that are coming in the business, they're all driven by what the next chapter in the solution is.
Right.
As opposed to saying, I've built this really cool software. I'm going to go out and find someone who wants to use it. It's like a completely different approach to it.
Mm-hmm.
And for us, it's been very easy to make the next decision always because it's been clear that that's the next thing that's going to unlock the next part of the problem.
Well, you're listening to your community.
I mean, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that that's like, that's key. But I do think that it can get confusing sometimes because actually being able to understand what is the problem that she's expressing, not necessarily what is she asking for, are two different things.
Completely.
And I don't think that any of the things that we've done have been explicitly feedback that customers have said they literally want X, Y, and Z. It's been her saying, I really hate this thing. Like, this is really like a challenge that I have. This is what's most uncomfortable to me. And us figuring out, okay, great. Like, we'll understand that and we'll build something for it. But we're not going to ask you what to build, which I think is a little bit harder.
Well, you're looking through the weeds.
Yeah.
You know, you're looking for those little red flags, you know, which is very different than just listening to, I really need a straight leg black pant.
Right. Which we can also make.
But you really want to understand, you know, what is the perfect one because this is what she's telling us.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. Well, congratulations on what you guys have done.
Thank you. It's been
I think that it's insanely impressive. And of course, you know, I've been watching from afar.
The one thing that I'll say, though, is that I think timing is really important. And I'm not sure that our business...
But honestly,
I don't think that our business could have existed or certainly couldn't have accelerated as quickly as it had even 5 years ago.
Well, it has become, you know, even starting with the whole brouhaha among these models that are so skinny, you know, that even, you know, France was like, if she weighs less than this, she can't go on the catwalk. I mean, so, you know, it was the beginning of a conversation. I mean, and even the conversations we're having about women today.
Absolutely.
You know, when people say, well, do you think that more women are going to be, you know, are going out there and building businesses and more women are getting funded? And the fact is, if someone is asking that and we're having the conversation, that means
something
that's
has changed.
Happening.
Yeah.
Right.
Something has changed. There's a reason why we're having these conversations.
Exactly. So I agree. I think timing is everything. And I do think even the timing for embracing all women for who they are, and we're all kind of bubbling to the top, I think is, you know, a really good thing. And the time has come.
Yeah.
And certainly the business you are in. I mean, Dia, I mean, the time has come. It should have come a long, long time ago.
I agree with
that. But you're right. I think that to accelerate from 2015 to now in what you have built and how large you have become is certainly has to do with timing.
Yeah, which we're grateful for. But I also think that we have a role to play in perpetuating that momentum. because I think that things like this can ebb and flow. And what we need to make sure doesn't happen is that this becomes less trendy or, you know, less of a focus, and that we're continuing to push the envelope on where this conversation goes next.
Yeah, I appreciate that, but I don't think it's going to ebb. I mean, the reality is everybody needs clothes, and everyone has to be clothed when they go outside. I mean,
clothing is not optional for
most people. Clothing is not optional, and women like to feel good about themselves when they walk out the door. I mean, one of my favorite quotes, you know, at the back of Vanity Fair when they do that one pager of someone. And it was Oscar De La Renta. And they asked him, what's the best thing you've ever purchased? And he said, well, of course, the last thing I purchased. I thought that was so great because, you know, that's the truth.
It
I mean,
the truth.
Every season you look in your clothes and you think, what did I wear last year?
Yeah.
And so I think that's important.
That's universal.
It is universal.
And that is what we believe more than anything else, is that there's no woman who doesn't want to be able to participate in that.
Right. There's no woman that doesn't want to feel good about themselves when they walk out the door. And everybody should be able to.
Without exception.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
Really appreciate
it. It's great to chat.
And I'm excited to watch Dia.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you to Nadia for joining me on the podcast this week. If you're interested in checking out what Dia & Co. is all about, you can visit them at Dia.com.